if only because then I would have nobody to parasitize.
The Kantian imperative seems to work for truth-telling and some other cases. It's not so easy to see how to broaden it to morality generally. Kant notwithstanding, it is tempting to agree with the hypothetical apologist that absolutist morals are usually driven by religion. Is it always wrong to put a terminally ill patient out of her misery at her own request? Is it always wrong to make love to a member of your own sex? Is it always wrong to kill an embryo? There are those who believe so, and their grounds are absolute. They brook no argument or debate. Anybody who disagrees deserves to be shot, metaphorically, of course, not literally, except in the case of some doctors in American abortion clinics. See next chapter. Fortunately, however, morals do not have to be absolute. Moral philosophers are the professionals when it comes to thinking about right and wrong. As Robert Hind succinctly put it, they agree that moral precepts, while not necessarily constructed by reason, should be defensible by reason. They classify themselves in many ways, but in modern terminology the major divide is between deontologists, such as Kant, and consequentialists, including utilitarians, such as Jeremy Bentham, 1748-1832. Deontology is a fancy name for the belief that morality consists in the obeying of rules. It is literally the science of duty, from the Greek for that which is binding. Deontology is not quite the same thing as moral absolutism, but for most purposes in a book about religion, there is no need to dwell on the distinction. Absolutists believe there are absolutes of right and wrong, imperatives whose rightness makes no reference to their consequences. Consequentialists more pragmatically hold that the morality of an action should be judged by its consequences. One version of consequentialism is utilitarianism, the philosophy associated with Bentham, his friend James Mill, 1773-1836, and Mill's son John Stuart Mill, 1806-1773. Utilitarianism is often summed up in Bentham's unfortunately imprecise catchphrase, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation."
Not all absolutism is derived from religion. Nevertheless, it is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones. The only competitor I can think of is patriotism, especially in times of war. As the distinguished Spanish film director Luis Buñuel said,
"God and country are an unbeatable team. They break all records for oppression and bloodshed."
Recruiting officers rely heavily on their victims' sense of patriotic duty. In the First World War, women handed out white feathers to young men not in uniform.
"Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go, for your king and your country both need you so."
People despised conscientious objectors, even those of the enemy country, because patriotism was held to be an absolute virtue. It is hard to get much more absolute than the "my country, right or wrong" of the professional soldier, for the slogan commits you to kill whomever the politicians of some future date might choose to call enemies. Consequentialist reasoning may influence the political decision to go to war, but once war is declared, absolutist patriotism takes over, with a force and a power not otherwise seen outside religion. A soldier who allows his own thoughts of consequentialist morality to persuade him not to go over the top would likely find himself court-martialed and even executed. The springboard for this discussion of moral philosophy was a hypothetical religious claim that, without a god, morals are relative and arbitrary. Kant, and other sophisticated moral philosophers apart, and with due recognition given to patriotic fervour, the preferred source of absolute morality is usually a holy book of some kind, interpreted as having an authority far beyond its history's capacity to justify. Indeed, adherents of scriptural authority show distressingly little curiosity about the normally highly dubious historical origins of their holy books. The next chapter will demonstrate that in any case, people who claim to derive their morals from scripture do not really do so in practice. And a very good thing too, as they themselves, on reflection, should agree.